Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the latest podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'm delighted you found us and you're listening. Now spread the word to your friends and neighbors, because you're in charge of marketing. Later in this podcast, David Cobb returns to our program. He was the Green Party's presidential nominee in 2004 and helped leverage what turned out to be a partial recount of the stolen presidential election in Ohio in 2004. And he and his group, Democracy Unlimited, are plaintiffs in the lawsuit that the Supreme Court has called a rare September session to discuss. And David Cobb's angle is corporate personhood. Now, I realize that's kind of an arcane, legal, mumbo-jumbo subject, but it has important implications in terms of free speech rights, corporations participating in elections, including writing big checks. And in a moment, Mel Goodman will join us. We'll talk about the Central Intelligence Agency and the Inspector General's report issued after 5 years on ice. As our pronouncer told you, listeners support this program, and I want to thank Paul L. Sesser of Durham, California, and Steve Fine of Mill Valley here in the Bay Area, both supporters of our program. You can help, too. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and it's right there on the homepage, the ways that you can help. Our music of the moment from the Detroit White Soul Band, Was Not Was. It's called Spy in the House of Love. And one of my favorite retired spooks is with us today, Melvin A. Goodman, because we honor middle initials here on this program. He is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and he also is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, an adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and he spent 42 years in service to our government at the CIA, the National War College, and in the U.S. Army. Mel Goodman, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, but if I'm the spy, where is this House of Love of which you speak?
I asked David Vitter.
Oh, I see. But anyway, I'm glad to be back.
It's good to talk with
you. Even though I'm in my own house.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in terms of this Inspector General's report, the Attorney General's decision to appoint a special counsel with sharply limited mission, and the policies that in some respects have been further detailed by the heavily redacted Inspector General's report. And where I'd like to start, Mel, is kind of at the top of the crime list, and that is that the Inspector General has affirmed that some suspects died in the custody of the Central Intelligence Agency. And I believe that he refers to three different incidents where the individuals died. But there have been news accounts of as many as 20 people who died in U.S. custody, not necessarily defined narrowly to the Central Intelligence Agency. To me, this kind of gets lost in all of the coverage of torture and who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. But to me, murder is more significant, more troubling than torture, even though I have concerns about both. So let's start there. What do we know about people who were held by the CIA and did not survive the experience?
Well, that's the problem. I have the Inspector General report right in front of me right now. I've read it thoroughly. And it's clear to me from maybe my CIA background that it's not that I'm reading between the lines, because there are no lines. I'm just reading redaction. But it's clear to me that a lot of the redacted sections deal with two things: deaths. The number 20 seems high to me, but the number 3 that's being used sounds very low.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere between 3 and 20, there were deaths, probably more at the hands of the military than the CIA, because there were far more detainees with the military than with the CIA.
Agreed.
But as you say, and you use the right word, crime list, and when I read this report, I feel like I'm reading a crime scene. There are deaths, but then the other category no one's talked about is missing detainees.
Mm-hmm.
Who disappeared from CIA custody? Who disappeared from military custody? Where are these people? Who are these people? Were names ever given to the international bodies like the International Red Cross? So this is a an ugly report, a sordid report to read. We're dealing with sadistic activities. The fact that 92 hours of torture tapes were destroyed clearly is obstruction of evidence. And I guess what worries me in terms of the special counsel who was appointed, John Dunham from Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
he's the one who's been looking at the destruction of the tapes for nearly 2 years now. He was supposed to be done, I think, last February at the latest. He got an extension. So I think people are excited about Dunham because he's kept the lid on and there have been no leaks. I'm not impressed that he's going to be the junkyard dog who's going to get to the bottom of this. But as you say, deaths have to be at the top of the list, but right behind that would be missing detainees. And the other heavily redacted sections, and again, this is only my assumption here, I have no evidence, is that there are huge sections. In fact, if you go to the index, they've even redacted the title of the section and the titles of all the subsections. There's one 20-page section, and given where it's placed, this had to deal with unauthorized and undocumented techniques. And even President Obama, who has said, I want to look forward and not backward, has said if people exceeded the guidelines of the Justice Department memos, which I think were corrupt in the first place, of
mm-hmm.
course, but if they exceeded those guidelines, then he would support criminal prosecution, that those people have to face the bar of justice. And then the final point I would make, and I've been conducting this campaign against the Washington Post, which is led by a neoconservative editor, Fred Hyatt, and sort of a fellow traveler for the CIA who's an op-ed writer by the name of David Ignatius.
Mm-hmm.
What these people don't understand or not willing to look at are the Nuremberg trial precedents. And there are two. Most people are familiar with one, that the fact that you are following an instruction or an order is not a defense. But the other aspect and lesson to be learned from Nuremberg was that an individual who commits activities that are considered to be crimes in the name of the state are responsible as individuals. They can't use the state as a cover to plead their non-involvement or their innocence. So I think Attorney General Eric Holder, who I think is the only hero in all of this, because he's under tremendous pressure from the CIA, from the intelligence community, from the military, even from the White House, which I find unacceptable, to not move on this activity. He read this report. Reports are he became sick to his stomach in reading it. He read it more than once. I don't know how he did that. I had to get up and wash my hands a few times just reading through this disgusting, unconscionable activity and think that Americans did this. This is here in America, where we thought we had principles and values and rule of law. So this is going to continue to, I think, dominate the news if the mainstream media sticks with this story, as they should. Mainstream media seems to have the patience and attention span of the shelf life of yogurt.
Yeah.
They can't stay with an issue very long unless they're given the headlines to write. But this is serious business. And I think you have to pursue accountability, you have to pursue transparency, and ultimately I think they're going to have to pursue prosecution. Whether they go that far or not is anybody's guess, because what we don't want to see, at least what I don't want to see, is what happened in Abu Ghraib, where they selected the 6 most junior people they could find, reservists from one of the poorest sections of the United States, Appalachia, partly from my own state of Maryland, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, and threw these kids into a courtroom, and then the military could say, oh, we've done our duty. We've punished these bad apples. We're not dealing with bad apples. If we're dealing with bad apples, the bad apples are George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Jay Bibby and John Yoo and Dick Addington and Bill Haynes. We know who they are. So this is very serious business that we're dealing with.
A couple of things I want to mention. One is that you can read recent posts by Mel Goodman. In particular, he's appointed himself ombudsman for the Washington Post, and somebody had to do it. Thank you, Mel.
They're unpaid ombudsman, I might add.
Well, and you still have to pay to get the paper, don't you?
That's true.
his pieces are cross-posted at two great nonprofit journalism sites, at consortiumnews.com and at the Public Record, which is pubrecord.org. And I encourage you to, when you have the time, to go take a look, and you'll get the details on these. Now, Mel, let me start here. Do we give the Obama administration some credit, some points, for allowing this report to be released at all? As I referenced, it was originally completed in 2004. It's been on ice for that length of time. And given the way Obama has kind of been picking and choosing, what constitutes a violation and what requires investigation and prosecution, is it in some way comforting that at least this report, as it was released?
Oh, I thoroughly agree with you. And you have to give him credit not only for this, but for closing down the secret prisons, which he did almost immediately, for announcing the closing of Guantanamo, but he's running into jingoist individuals in the Senate and House who are not going to permit the closing down so easily, the way he's ended torture and abuse. And I know maybe progressives are asking for too much, but I think we have to keep holding his feet to the fire. I think he's very leery to move in the direction of a special prosecutor. I think he was dragging his heels on this report. I still believe Eric Holder did a courageous thing in releasing it the way he did. And I'm told in the original version, and the reason why he held it up, that's Holder, held up this report, that the CIA redacted about all the 10 or 20 pages of this 130-page report. Including sections dealing with the legal definitions of terrorism, things that were clearly not classified or secret. And I've always said, don't fall for this notion of State Secrets Act or State Secrets Defense that even the Obama administration is using. There are very few state secrets. What you're dealing with is state embarrassment.
Yeah.
And you can't hide evidence because you're going to be embarrassed as a state or as an individual or as a political administration. So, yes, Obama does deserve credit. But as long as he's willing to believe that we want to look forward and not backward, I think we have to hold his feet to the fire because, as Senator Leahy from Vermont said, you can't turn the page on this until you know what's written on the page. And I'm looking at a document that has about 40 pages that are fully redacted and another 20 that are partially redacted. So we still don't know what's on the page. And I don't believe there are any actual secrets that are in here. There's very embarrassing material in here. There's no question of that. The whole document is an embarrassment. And there's one other issue that needs to be addressed because no one has addressed this issue. The only... And this is ironic in a way. The only good, comprehensive, official account we have of this whole messy affair comes from the Central Intelligence Agency. It was the Office of the Inspector General. As you say, it was done 5 years ago. Now, why doesn't someone ask two questions? Someone like Dianne Feinstein, who was supposed to be the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, for crying out loud. She should be asking two questions. Why was there never a follow-up report done by the IG's office, which is always done in the case of ongoing problems such as this one? And two, since the IG who was responsible for this, a fellow by the name of John Helgerson, who I've known for about 25, 30 years, he announced his retirement in February. That's more than 7 months ago. The CIA has been without a statutory IG for over 7 months. Now, if Dianne Feinstein was a real chairman of this intelligence committee, she'd be banging on the walls at CIA and the White House to name a statutory IG. It's one of the few oversight offices you have, since the Senate and House oversight committees are in total disarray. The 9/11 report called them dysfunctional, and that was one of the few things the 9/11 report I could wholeheartedly agree with. So we need to know, why no follow-up? What has happened to the office of the IG? And why don't we have a statutory IG, particularly at this very important time? And, of course, that raises questions about the terrible job that Leon Panetta has done. And here I have to give some crow, because I wrote an op-ed the day he was announced by President Obama, praising this appointment, an op-ed for the Baltimore Sun. And ever since his confirmation testimony, which when it was clear he was already captured or surrendered to the operational director of the CIA.
Yeah, Kit Bond just talked him right down.
It's been an embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
And
I share that. I've known Leon Panetta since he was a member of Congress. His base is in Carmel Valley, which is where our radio station is licensed to. And I have respect and fondness for him up until he took the job at the agency. And he has performed in a way that is embarrassing to me. It is shameful to his own record as a politician and a public servant. And it's a lose-lose proposition, because as he attempts to defend what is clearly indefensible, he loses credibility with the public, and he wins no favors internally. At least that's my estimation. You serve there. Will he curry favor with the individuals in the agency by these lame efforts to explain away what was clearly wrong?
Well, the very people he's defending there, the operational people who came up with all these programs, secret prisons, extraordinary renditions and torture and abuse, behind his back, they refer to him as Uncle Leon. They don't take him very seriously at all, even though they have captured him, essentially, and he is doing exactly what they want him to do. But at the confirmation hearings, it was Dianne Feinstein who almost made a condition of her vote that he would keep people like Stephen Kappes as the deputy director of the CIA. Well, Stephen Kappes was the ideological driver of all of these policies, and there were so many people in the operational directorates who opposed Kappes because of his support for renditions and secret prisons. You know, the media line, that I'm talking about the mainstream media line, has been, see, you can't investigate the CIA. You'll demoralize these people. You can't have prosecutions, because then these operational people will start to slow roll all of these operations, because they will be so demoralized. Nonsense. It's just the other way around. If you don't pursue these bad actors who are responsible for virtually all of these crimes that have been committed, and it's a very small group of people at the high level, then you're demoralizing the very people who put their careers on the line by fighting these things. And another story that hasn't been told is one of the reasons why the CIA had to go to contractors for the assassination program, those phonies and criminals at Blackwater, as well as for the torture and abuse program, those two phony military psychologists who knew nothing about Al-Qaeda, knew nothing about terrorism, had never conducted an interrogation, is because there was so much resistance within the building from places like the Office of Medical Services and elsewhere against these programs, considering them illegal and immoral. And people don't want to deal with this part of the story. There's so many people like David Ignatius at the Washington Post who are what? I remember Stalin had this great phrase for journalists who would buy the Soviet line at very delicate times in Soviet history. He referred to them as useful idiots. Ignatius has become a useful idiot for the CIA. It begs the question of, is he on the payroll of the CIA? Who's paying this guy? And just one day after the next, you see another op-ed or another editorial saying, you can't have prosecutions, we must move on. These were good people doing their job, and after all, these issues were put before the Justice Department in 2004 with his IG report, and the attorneys did nothing about it. Well, that was George Bush's Justice Department. It was a totally politicized institution. We know how corrupt it was.
Yeah, we had Mukasey there saying, well, if they had a memo, then whatever they did was legal.
Exactly.
And we know that that's just pure bullshit.
Yeah, well, the CIA, the Washington Post the other day said you have to give the CIA credit for going to the Justice Department for guidance on things like torture and abuse. They didn't go there for guidance. They went there for protection. I mean, these lawyers like Jay Bybee and John Yoo, who teaches at the University of California, which must be embarrassing to all of you out there.
It is.
They're like mafia lawyers. They gave protection to these people. You know, what do you need? We can write it. We can put it into law. The fact of the matter is, and the report proves this, the tortures began before they even got the memos.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't waiting for this memoranda coming out of these five memoranda coming out of the Justice Department. These were ideological drivers. Stephen Kappas, who's deputy director, as I mentioned, Michael Sulik, who's head of the National Clandestine Service, John Rizzo, who's still the acting general counsel. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, the Senate did not confirm Rizzo. He's about to be replaced, or maybe has recently been replaced, come to think of it. But basically, Panetta kept all of these people. These are the people who explained to him what the CIA was all about. Now Panetta's on board with the company line, and frankly, he's making a fool out of himself.
Well, now we have Brennan, John Brennan, who was a deputy at the CIA under Tenet. He's over at the White House running interference.
This is unbelievable to me, too, because I thought the Brennan nomination, he was going to be the CIA director for mm-hmm. Obama, and I was one of the blockers who was dismissed by an article in The New Yorker. They described this as people sitting around in their underwear in their basements at their computers eating Cheetos coming after John Brennan. I had that article up on my wall. In fact, I'm asking my wife to take a picture of me tonight, my underwear, eating Cheetos behind my computer so I could put the picture up on the wall.
And for the record right now, do you have more than underwear on?
No shoes. That's what I like about radio. You don't wear shoes.
Yeah, no shoes, no shirt, no problem. Now, Mel, I want to come back to a phrase that you used that came out of these sympathetic editorials by the Washington Post, slow rolling. First of all, give us a quick definition of that.
Slow rolling is if you're given an assignment that appears to be controversial, you'll move very slowly. You really won't take on the task. You won't show any vigor, any conviction, any tenacity. You will just play this out to the end of time so that the job never gets done, which is really nonsense.
Or as Kyle Sampson, the Republican in the Justice Department a few years ago said, well, we just gum it to death and run out the clock.
Yeah, right. It's all about running out the clock.
So my question is John Dunham a slow roller? Was he selected so that they could, you know, offer this this one-day story of a prosecutor who has been appointed, and then hope that this just goes away for as long as possible?
Well, there are a lot of people who know John Dunham, I don't, who have a lot of faith in John Dunham. So I think time will tell on that one. I don't think he can just slow roll this one, because Eric Holder has put his own reputation on the line. He's taken on the CIA, and to a degree he's taken on the National Security Council, because Brennan, the deputy over there, who I think will soon become the National Security Advisor because General Jones is doing such a mediocre job, we're putting a lot of pressure on the Justice Department. So I don't think Dunham can do that, but don't expect anything to happen very soon.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the record, I am changing my spectacles right now, and I have just donned a pair of SunCloud sunglasses, and these have the rose tint to them.
Oh, my.
And I'm looking through my rose-colored glasses right now, Mel, and I've heard a number of commentators, including progressive friends of mine in the media, who say, well, this is a victory. We've got a special counsel. And once he starts diving into this, he cannot possibly limit it the way Holder has defined his mission. He can't just find the people who exceeded the memos that were, you know, legally corrupt, that allowed them to do waterboarding and conduct other forms of so-called enhanced interrogation. So the rose-colored glasses are my way of describing the hope that this guy Dunham will run with the ball and go much further than Eric Holder or Barack Obama currently expects. Your thought?
Well, that would really stun me, because once you cross that line, then you're going all the way to Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. There are no intermediate points along the way. go to the end of the line. And this, all of this was directed from the very top. Cheney, through his lawyer David Addington, into the Justice Department with Ashcroft and Gonzalez, and lawyers like Bobby and John Yoo. And I don't think there's any stomach for that by any political or bureaucratic group in this city right now. But as you say, once they start turning over these rocks, they're going to find, according to a psychiatrist I talked to at the CIA, a sordid, sadistic mess. It is going to be so ugly and so unbelievably ugly that maybe you're right. Maybe they won't be able to stop.
Well, I mean, one scenario that I would offer is, okay, we find a contractor or a CIA employee who exceeded the guidelines and tortured or killed somebody. And they turn around and say, well, I was getting constant emails from the National Security Council, from the Principal's Committee, relayed by Condoleezza Rice, that explicitly told me I could do these things. Now, that's my rosiest scenario, Mel, and I'm not too optimistic that it will actually play out. But it does seem to me that these are cans of worms that are very hard to contain.
Well, that's true. And the paper trail is there, because one thing that the CIA did, remember, it's a bureaucracy just like all other bureaucracies. Maybe once upon a time the CIA was freewheeling, but by the time of the Church Commission in the 1970s and the beginning of the oversight process, which worked for about 15 years, they became a very bureaucratic institution, and they sort of killed people with a paper flow, and there are documents for everything, and they're going to find all sorts of emails in from the field. They're going to find very vivid descriptions of all of the interrogation sessions and all of the torture and abuse, and when they went beyond the limit and when they didn't. And I'm sure a lot of this is going to point to sadistic activity. And the fact that they took the very risky step, which I think was risky because it was obstruction of justice, of destroying the 92 hours of torture tapes, shows how ugly it was, because they took the risk that it's better to destroy these and face the consequences than to let anybody see these tapes. But people have seen them. What I don't understand is why in the world the Senate Intelligence Committee hasn't subpoenaed the people who've seen the tapes to give their description of what's on the tapes. This should not be a mystery. And it's a secret, but it shouldn't be a mystery. Mm-hmm. And right now it's just a mystery.
Mel Goodman with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Mel, I started off with kind of this descending list of offenses that are to some extent described or detailed in this the Inspector General's report. So we talked about murders, we talked about disappearance. Now, assassinations have surfaced in some recent pretty good reporting from the New York Times. And this appears to dovetail with Seymour Hersh's allegation that there were death squads that were under the control of the vice president. We also understand from some recent court filings that Eric Prince of Blackwater was hired on a verbal contract to provide essentially assassins who were at that point charged with finding and killing Osama bin Laden. And they were told, just bring back his head. I want to deliver that to Bush. This is a clear violation of our laws that came out of the Church Commission reforms of the 1970s. And yet there is a desire to rationalize this. That, well, 9/11 changed everything, and that we have the unfettered right to simply track him down and kill him. And I do understand people's attitudes about that, but it is in direct conflict with our laws, and we haven't changed those laws.
No, what you would do once you move in that direction is create a lawless society, which I think someone like Dick Cheney, who wanted to be the law, it was sort of one man, one vote, and that one man was going to be Dick Cheney. He was creating his own society, his own laws, and that would include warrantless eavesdropping, and the worst would be this assassination plan that he gave to the CIA with instructions that they couldn't report any of this to the Congress, which was also a violation of law. And it was up to the CIA. Someone should have had the backbone to stand up to the vice president and say, we can't do this. show you how stupid and to show you the cupidity, not only stupidity of the CIA, but to turn around and give this to Blackwater, a group of thugs, you know, that means they learned nothing or had no memory about the CIA turning to the mafia in 1960 to go after Fidel Castro in Operation Mongoose, which was part of like 12 different assassination attempts against Fidel Castro. That some they conducted themselves, and some they were in-house, and some were out-house. The mafia was a clear case of the out-house ruling the day. But you can't get any lower than the Blackwater Group, which means that the CIA was trying to avoid accountability and trying to stay as far away from this while following the lines that Dick Cheney was setting down. But this intimidation by Dick Cheney of the entire bureaucracy, which goes back, of course, to their positions leading up to the Iraq War when they prepared all the phony intelligence for Dick Cheney because of the pressure from Dick Cheney's office and Scooter Libby, who was part of that program that led to the outing of Valerie Plame, which was really a treasonous act on Dick Cheney's part.
Mm-hmm.
So much of this, it's Dick Cheney's fingerprints all over it, and now he's angry, and apparently he's writing a book in which he's going to be very critical of George Bush for throwing Dick Cheney over the side. Well, he didn't throw him far enough, and he didn't throw him soon enough, and he didn't throw him fast enough to save the country from the kind of disgrace that we're facing now.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do we deal with this? Because there is a sentiment driven by popular television shows like 24 that we have the absolute right, and people consider it moral, to go and take out and assassinate somebody like Osama bin Laden. And I agree with you that it leads us to the precipice, if not beyond, of just vigilante justice and do as we say, not or do as we tell you to do, don't do what we say. And I just think that we see Obama buffeted by these cross currents right now on a relatively simple issue like closing Guantanamo and transferring a couple of dozen prisoners to supermax prisons inside the United States. So how do we educate the American public and get beyond the hysteria that is generated because people have been so feared up that their reflex is to say, well, gee, that's okay with me?
Well, someone is going to have to take over the leadership reins on this issue. And I think the only one who could do it effectively, and he's certainly well-positioned to do it, would be President Obama. Now, here we are faced with probably the most eloquent president we've had in the last 100 years, with the exception of Franklin Roosevelt. No one can give a speech more effectively than Barack Obama.
Yeah, but he went to the National Archives, stood in front of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and split hairs.
And
said military commissions, well, we're going to use them a little.
Well, the problem was, once he came into office, and I think the signal was when he kept Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, sending the signal that there's no one in the Democratic Party who has Democratic Party experience who's qualified to lead the Pentagon at this time. That was a shocking decision on his part. The Economist magazine a couple weeks ago said he may be the best Secretary of Defense in the history of the United States. Well, that if you accept that, then it means that the war in Afghanistan is the best war we've ever fought in the history of the United States. No, clearly Obama has faced a lot of pressure from the military and from the intelligence community, and he's feeling the heat. That's why I said at the beginning of our conversation here that someone is going to have to hold his feet to the fire, and it's going to take senators who have a certain standing in the Congress, and they're just a small group there, and the media and opinion leaders. But frankly, we don't have that kind of leadership in this country right now. I still think we're lucky to have Obama in the White House. I still can't think of anyone I'd rather have in the White House right now than Barack Obama. But we've watched him now on the health care debate, where I think he's shown real signs of nervousness. We've seen him on various military and defense and intelligence. intelligence issues where he's backed away from the fight. He's held up the release of military photos of torture, which he said he was going to release. The Pentagon gate got to him on that one. He wasn't giving Holder any real help in releasing this document. He was still saying up to recently, we've got to look forward and not backwards. So, yeah, the pressure has to be kept on Obama. And he's bright enough and sensitive enough and concerned enough about the domestic and international implications of all of these issues to do the right thing. This is a very smart man. But he tries to keep everyone happy. I don't think he wants to discourage anyone, and he certainly doesn't want to alienate any group. And that worries me, too, because they're tough decisions that have to be made, and he's the one who's going to have to make them. They're not going to be made anywhere else. The Congress is what someone called the broken branch of government. It doesn't function very well. Again, look at the health reform debate as it's being played out.
So well, if I can just pigeonhole the series of comments you just made as criticisms of passivity or you know, things in that direction by Obama, I have some serious criticisms of things in the active mode where he has maintained the domestic surveillance program that illegally wiretaps my phone calls and my emails in direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the FISA reform law last summer doesn't do anything to reduce that constitutional conflict. Not only that, he has expanded on the premise of state secret privilege that was abused by the Bush administration to try to prevent you know, civil cases and criminal prosecutions that would expose the wiretapping issue, that in the case of Binyan Muhammad, the British citizen, would detail the torture and detention policies that we're talking about here today. And so there have been active efforts by the Obama administration to obstruct the transparency that Obama talked about and to prevent us from returning to constitutional rule. And I have serious problems, and the question I put to you, and I don't know that you have an answer, but I got to ask it, is why would he be covering, you very carefully and explicitly said, we don't really have state secrets, we have state embarrassments. So with Dick Cheney hectoring him from the stands, why on earth is Barack Obama going to such great lengths to protect the wrongdoing and embarrassing actions of the prior administration?
Well, I agree with most of what you're saying, and I remember, I think the last time we talked was the inauguration day, the day I rode my bike down to the hall to watch the inauguration address, and on my way back, I was frozen. I don't even know if I made any sense that day because my teeth were chattering. So I told you about the wonderful impact of that speech, which talked about restoring the rule of law and creating the United States or recreating the United States the way the founding fathers wanted it. And here is a constitutional lawyer who understands all of these issues. And then he goes into office. And I thought he caved in very quickly on some of these issues. The FISA Act, as you say, and using the state security proviso.
Which is not a law, by the way.
That's why I was sorry to say the word law, but it isn't a law.
No.
Frankly, when I think of state security, I think of the fact that we have 14 Trident submarines and 12 aircraft carriers. Well, that's what protects state security. I don't see any risk to life and limb in the United States coming from these cases. And the one he fought, or that he introduced the state security privilege, was the one involving the subcontractor from Boeing who was transporting these detainees, and who knows whether they were guilty of anything or not, back and forth across European countries on their way to secret prisons in Guantanamo. And I was appalled when he used state security for that. Again, you're only talking about embarrassing other nations and ourselves and maybe the Boeing Corporation because this was very widespread activity. But this is a concern, and that's why I keep saying, yeah, you're going to have to hold this guy's feet to the fire because other groups are pressuring him, and it's important for progressives to apply pressure too. And I think on the IG report, 2004, that's just been released, we have to thank the ACLU, perhaps without that lawsuit, we wouldn't have gotten this report, even in this redacted form.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the theories that other guests have offered in response to similar questions, Mel, is that once you become president, you're not interested in giving up an iota of power. But it really strikes me that this administration at least continues to use the option of rendition. We don't have any evidence that someone has been rendered in the last 8 months. But, of course, those things are not widely disclosed to begin with. And so,
but let me say one thing here about renditions. Even mm-hmm. though we haven't given up the option, it's going to be very difficult to render because I don't know one country in the European Union that is going to allow a CIA plane or a subcontractor's plane to land within its borders to transport prisoners back and forth from Guantanamo to secret prisons. And no one has really talked about that. The European Union countries, both in East and West Germany, have been totally embarrassed by the high-handed tactics that the CIA used. And just as they didn't fully brief the Congress about all of their plans, and Nancy Pelosi, I think, can't claim she was lied to, but she was given very convoluted and partial information. The European Union, I think, are not going to allow secret facilities within their borders. They're not going to be allowed. They're not going to allow prisoners to be transported, and they're not going to take part in renditions on European soil, which happened in Italy and Germany and Spain. So there, I'm not as concerned as I am about some of the things that you cited earlier.
Okay, but they announced one reform is that there will now be a renditions committee, and John Brennan at the White House sits on it. And so they've pledged not to render somebody to a country where they would be tortured. Well, why the hell do we need to render anybody to begin with?
Well, we shouldn't render anybody, and John Brennan shouldn't be in the White House. Here I would go a little further. How in the world did John Brennan end up in the White House? And here it really points to Obama's lack of knowledge or naivete about a series of national security issues. And I have two problems there. One is, he appointed his very weak national security team of General Jones and Hillary Clinton and Bob Gates, and then he appoints all of these special experts on areas like Pakistan and the Middle East and Iran, which really confuses the chain of command within the White House and the State Department on who's to really be pursuing policy in all of these areas. And he just does not have that experience. He was only in Washington for 4 years as a senator, and two of those years he was out crisscrossing the country in his successful run for the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a very inexperienced individual and a very inexperienced national security team. And I think we were lucky in the case of North Korea, the way that was handled by Bill Clinton, and the North Koreans deserve a lot of credit. But Afghanistan continues to get worse. Iraq continues to get worse. Iran continues to get worse. The problem of Israel continues to get worse. And with all of these special talent like George Mitchell and Richard Holbrooke and Dennis Ross, I don't see any strategic plan whatsoever. I don't see any example of strategic thinking. And now we have a national security advisor who's so inarticulate, he can't even face the media anyway.
Well, that's a stunning commentary. Mel,
maybe that's a good place to leave it.
Yeah. Well, Mel, we've got a lot of work to do here, and I hope people will continue to pay attention on these issues, continue, as you say, to hold feet to the fire. And we need to do it on all fronts. We have a Congress that has shown little interest in rising to its oversight responsibilities. And now that's because they're Democrats and we have a Democratic president. And that is as unacceptable to me as their passivity was under Bush.
Yeah, I find them just totally inept and uninformed. I talked to someone who worked for a while on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he said there isn't a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee who really understands the intelligence community, who knows the difference between a clandestine action and a covert action, and this includes the leadership as well as the lower-ranking members of the committee. So, as I said before, this is the broken branch of government, and that's part of our problem. A mainstream media that doesn't allow contrarians to express their views, a court system that doesn't take on cases that deal with national security, and a Congress that is dysfunctional. So that's why I'm glad you're still in the saddle. I'm glad you're doing what you do, and these issues can be discussed.
Melvin A. Goodman. Pick up his latest book, Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Is that out in softcover now?
No, and I'm not sure that it will be.
Okay, then buy the hardcover.
Buy the hardcover.
And read it. All right, Mel, you can get dressed now and put down the Cheetos.
I'll put the shoes on. Thank you, Peter B.
Great to talk with you, Mel Goodman.
Bye now.
And the Peter B. Collins Show rolls on. This portion sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins Show listeners. And check out that Prosecco. What a great wine that is.
I don't know what matters to you at this moment, but that's all that matters to me. How are you?
And David Cobb returns to our program today. He was the Green Party's presidential candidate, the nominee in 2004. And I am forever grateful to David Cobb for providing the basis for a partial recount of the stolen presidential election from my birth state of Ohio in 2004. David, welcome back to the program today.
Thank you so much, Peter B. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, and I very much appreciate that you're willing to call it the way it is and acknowledge that George Bush stole not one but two elections. And
yes.
You know what? I'm not over it, and I'm not going to get over it.
Good for you. As you know, all this talk about moving forward and not looking backward, well, you know, a lot of people liked the outcome of the election in 2008 at the presidential level. But I have no more confidence that that was an accurate vote count than what we had was clearly purloined in 2004 and clearly decided by the Supreme Court in 2000.
Well, I'm with you on that one. I would say this. If we really are going to create the world that we so desperately need and so richly deserve, we're going to have to build a broad-based social movement that goes beyond elections.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we should vote, but we should also be involved in the kind of day-to-day organizing activity that meets our real needs on the ground while building a movement that will literally change the social, political, and economic system under which we live.
Well, I want to talk with you about that a few minutes, because like a lot of progressives, I'm very disappointed in the early days of the Obama administration. And I'm also disappointed that many progressives are on the sidelines, not actively involved, as we see some mobsters and yahoos take over what passes for a debate on the health care proposals that are under consideration right now. But let's get to that in a few minutes. I want to talk to you about a critical Supreme Court case that your group, Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, is a lead plaintiff in. And this involves some very critical issues. And some people will focus on the fact that Sonia Sotomayor, the newest Supreme Court justice, and I've been saving this line, she can now move from being a wise Latina to a wise-ass Latina because she's got a lifetime appointment. And she doesn't have to worry about Jeff Sessions looking over her shoulder ever again. But many people know that they kind of, escalated the process of confirming her because Chief Justice Roberts called an unusual September session for the Supreme Court to review this case that originated in the presidential campaign last year, when there was a documentary, and I'm using air quotes around that, but a propaganda piece that was produced that was critical of candidate Hillary Clinton. And the Federal Elections Commission, as I recall, invoked the McCain-Feingold law, and they were having a tough time deciding whether under the First Amendment this qualified as a political piece or as more of advocacy. And tell me how Democracy Unlimited has joined the plaintiff side of this case before the court.
Well, you're right. The Chief Justice Roberts has used this dispute as an opportunity to revisit a longstanding rule that in federal elections, corporations are prohibited to making direct political contributions to candidates' campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it should be said that for basically for over 100 years, this has been prohibited. That has been eroded through the use of the principle or the legal doctrine of corporate personhood. If corporations are persons under law, then they should have First Amendment free speech protections, and so then any attempt to restrict their political speech then comes under strict scrutiny. And so over the last, say, 25 years, the various restrictions on corporate First Amendment free speech rights have basically been stripped away. The one that was still in place was that in federal elections, corporations were not allowed to make direct political contributions, and the Supreme Court up until that point had said that those sorts of laws did not violate corporations' First Amendment free speech rights.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Justice Roberts is using this as an opportunity to reconsider that case, and I think quite bluntly because he's counting votes and he thinks that it's an opportunity to strip away one of the last remaining restrictions on corporate control of our elections. And frankly, it's a pretty flimsy restriction to begin with, but at least it's there. So Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County wanted to use this as an opportunity to not only argue that that law should be upheld, but that the entire doctrine of corporate personhood should be revisited and ultimately overturned.
Mm-hmm.
And for your listeners, Peter B., I want to be clear. Corporate personhood is the legal doctrine that allows corporations to claim the constitutional, political, and civil liberties and rights that living, breathing persons have.
Right.
So we're using this not because we think that we'll get this court to overturn that doctrine, but because we want to start to raise awareness of people to understand that this legal doctrine matters. It's the reason that we cannot genuinely control the corporate abuse and harm that we are suffering on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so at Democracy Unlimited, we have filed an amicus brief with the U.S. Supreme Court challenging the very idea that corporations should be persons with constitutional rights.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see if the Roberts Court, as it's now constituted, considers that issue worth taking up. What I've seen in, you know, Roberts' pattern of cases so far is an effort to, you know, find either a way to avoid ruling on the central issue by looking at issues of standing and, you know, whether or not somebody has the right to sue, as opposed to the merits of the meat of the matter. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly what issues they do take up related to this, the central point of the case, which is the this film that they wanted to show that was critical of Hillary Clinton during the campaign last year. But David, I want to take a moment here to explore the origins of this. And I'm not expert on the free speech rights and the relationship of corporate personhood to those claims. But I do have a fascination with the corporate structure in this country. And it came about through a business deal. I was a partner in a small business, and one of my partners died. And I learned the hard way the laws of joint and several liability. And what it meant was that when my partner died, I was responsible for his debts in the partnership. And it almost led me to bankruptcy. And so it was one of those, learn-by-doing experiences in my life. As a result, I did a lot of research, and the only book I've ever published was a manual on how to incorporate in Nevada. And I wrote it because it was a learning experience for me on, as a business person, how to limit my liabilities. And I do appreciate that aspect of the corporate form. And I decry that in the past year, instead of allowing that system to work, and allow AIG and other troubled companies to go into bankruptcy, we saw this socialist intervention on a massive scale to socialize the losses of these private corporations. And so, you know, what I'm trying to say here is that I don't throw out the corporate structure entirely. The problem I have is that it's been badly abused, And we have boards of directors that don't honor their fiduciary obligation to shareholders. Instead, they honor a private loyalty to the CEO and shower him or her with unearned stock options and obscene salaries and things of that sort. When it comes to the corporate personhood issue, though, I find it a pretty cut and dried matter.
And I want to be clear about this. I don't actually consider myself an anti-corporate activist.
Mm-hmm.
I and Democracy Unlimited are democracy activists, and we think that the huge transnational corporations are preventing genuine democracy in the United States of America. And in your anecdote, in your personal experience, Peter, the reality is that limited liability was the right form.
Mm-hmm.
We're not actually challenging the principle of limited liability. We're not challenging the idea that corporations can't serve useful purposes.
Well, but let me continue, because my submission is this, that in order to shield the individual from losses, a corporation is formed. And by very definition, it is not a person. It does not have the characteristics of a person. It is designed to shield a person from excessive liability,
exactly,
from liability beyond their own investment. And so to me, it's very simple. And again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not schooled in all the precedents, but it just seems very black and white to me, David, that a corporation cannot, you know, claim the limited liability at the same time that it claims the rights of a person.
You know, Peter B., what you've just exactly zeroed in on how incredibly inconsistent the logic and the framework is for the whole doctrine of corporate personhood. And in a nutshell, it's important to understand that this doctrine is only being used by the huge transnational corporations. It only matters whenever they are trying to go into court to overturn a law, whether it was passed at the local level, the state level, or even the federal level, trying to overturn a law that attempts to control their conduct or harm. You know, the reality is that the overwhelming majority of corporations in this country never go into court affirmatively trying to overturn a law.
Mm-hmm.
So corporate personhood only benefits the huge transnational corporations. It is one of the linchpin legal arguments that has allowed them to become really the dominant institutions of our culture. And that's the reason why we at Democracy Unlimited are trying to target an educational campaign and ultimately a movement to overturn and abolish this odious legal doctrine so that we can actually make the promise of democracy a reality in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to delve a little bit into the history here, and conveniently, an email arrived. I'm on a listserv that Mark Crispin Miller delivers 10 or 12 emails a day of interesting materials. He's a professor at New York University, and he, just a week ago, circulated an article written by Richard Behan, B-E-H-A-N, and it's at commondreams.org, and it is a reprint of an article that goes all the way back to 2002, and it was a review of Tom Hartman's book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. Many people know my friend Tom, the syndicated progressive radio host, who is also a very thoughtful man and published 20 books, many of them rich in history.
And that, by the way, is, in my estimation, his best book.
Okay. So Hartman and Behan are tracing the origins of this, and it goes back to a Supreme Court decision in 1886. Santa Clara County, which is the county that comprises Silicon Valley and San Jose, versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. And in it, not in the ruling itself, but in a headnote, Hartman quotes as follows: "The defendant corporations are persons within the intent of the clause in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which forbids a state to deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." So is this, in your view, do you share that this is the origin of the current concept of corporate personhood, David?
Well, it is the first time that the Supreme Court allegedly ever made that assertion. The reality is that corporate lawyers have been arguing before that case and ultimately after that case to try to get this to be deemed as persons under the law, because if they do so, then it gives them an enormous shield against the actions of legislatures acting on behalf of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that, Peter B., is because, look, we understand that human individual persons do have profound political and civil liberties, and the majority cannot impinge upon those. So I am a huge civil libertarian, as you well know,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely defend the political and civil rights of people, including people with whom I vehemently disagree. The difference is, if we allow a corporation to use that same shield, they are able to prevent the democratic exercise of control over our society, over our economy, over our medical care system. Basically, corporate personhood prevents democracy from being able to be realized.
And in Humboldt County, you have attempted to codify this. It was through a ballot measure that explicitly stated that corporations could not participate in the initiative process, and this grew out of a case involving Pacific Lumber, its parent Palco, and tell us what the status of that is right now. That has been overturned, am I correct?
Well, it wasn't overturned, but it's no longer the law. You're correct. Democracy Unlimited, we drafted a model law that would say corporations cannot contribute to local elections, not to candidate elections, not to citizens' initiatives, not to recalls, not to anything. It was an effort to make it clear that no corporate money should corrupt or otherwise degrade the electoral process. We also wrote into that law a direct challenge to the notion of corporate personhood by saying, and corporations cannot legitimately claim to be persons under the law with First Amendment rights, to try to overturn this law in court, directly provoking and challenging this legal precedent of over 100 years. Now, we were actually sued by a right-wing think tank, the Pacific Legal Foundation, whose clients include Philip Morris Corporation, the ExxonMobil Corporation, Archer Daniels Midland Corporation, the General Electric Corporation, I mean, the big boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually sued. First Amendment constitutional rights were being violated. The case ultimately was settled out of court because supervisors for Humboldt County were unwilling to incur the legal costs associated with trying to defend the law that was passed by 55% of the voters. So one of the things that we do at Democracy Unlimited is to reach out to other citizens, other communities, asking them to join us in a legal resistance movement. Let's use our own local communities as a way to fight back against this legal doctrine and to fight back against the concentrated power of corporations, and ultimately build a movement that will be as powerful as the abolitionist movement of another era, as powerful as the women's suffrage movement, as powerful as the trade union movement. I mean, we need a movement at that level if we're going to actually be serious about changing the country.
Now, David, I read a news account the other day that the chairman of the state Republican Party of California and a couple of high-priced lawyers are on their way to Washington to also participate in this Supreme Court oral arguments, I presume. And so this is turning into a major, and it could be perhaps a landmark decision coming from the court, because the combatants here clearly take this as a very serious issue that could, in the case of corporations, advance that selfish interest.
There is no doubt about it. And the fact that the right wing is basically amassing its forces is an indication of just how seriously they take it. And I'm asking listeners of your show, Peter B., to join with us to build a countervailing force to those right-wingers. And I would invite them to check us out online at www.duhc.org, stands for Democracy Unlimited Humboldt County.
Mm-hmm.
And let's demonstrate, regardless of what political party you're associated with, whether or not you believe in electoral politics, we need the people mobilizing in a mass way to actually fight back against the corporatists who are literally destroying our planet.
The other website I'll mention is the attorney representing you and others in this case is Jeffrey Clements. And at his website, ClementsLLC.com, you can read the amicus brief. It's Clements with an S, ClementsLLC.com. And I'll put that and the DUHC address up in the podcast information related to this program. David, what else would you like to add regarding this case and what could come out of it?
Well, I think the first thing that I would like to share with your listeners, Peter B., is that you can do it, too, in your community, that we are in the early stages of working with people across the country to propose a constitutional amendment overturning this legal doctrine. So there is a way to use the legislative process. There's a way to use the legal process. And ultimately, we need to start using the people's media, like your radio show and podcast, to begin to educate one another. Without the corporate filter, without the ability to talk to one another and tell the truth. Of course, it's ridiculous and absurd that a corporation should be considered a person under law with constitutional rights, and yet that is the law. So I think it's important that we actually begin to put the great words of Arundhati Roy into play. You know, she said, we must fight empire. We must resist empire. But we must also mock empire. We must laugh at empire. In other words, we need to appropriately ridicule the idea that a corporation should be considered a person. That's just crazy. And we ought to say it. And we ought to say it to our neighbors, our friends, our family members. We ought to start engaging in the kind of discussion that will actually create the cultural awareness and ultimately the space for the kind of movement to come into being that you and I and all of your listeners want to be part of.
Well, I certainly embrace that approach, and Arundhati Roy is a brilliant woman. And I think that because these issues are complex and considered dull by many people, that we need to dramatize what the impact is. And as you point out, just how ridiculous it is for a corporation that can overpay its chief executive at the expense of shareholders, that can operate in a predatory manner, and it can claim liability protection from losses that it generates, can then turn around and claim that it also enjoys the rights of a person. And I think we need some, you know, flash-animated video cartoons and maybe somebody who can get on Jon Stewart's Daily Show and serve this up in a way that projects those ironies and contradictions in a clear and also ridiculous manner.
Perfect. Well said. And I want to encourage any of your listeners who have any such talents in either art or flash animation or our political theater, contact us. We want to work with you. Let's build that movement.
Well, this inspires me. I'm going to talk to Mark Fiore. Mark is the cartoonist at Mark Fiore, FIORE.com. And if you just check out some of his political cartoons that are done using flash animation, he's the guy for this. So I'm gonna talk to him, David, and see if we can get him on board.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Any other of your co-plaintiffs in this case that you'd like to note that you think might be interesting to our listeners?
I think that at the national level, the group that is probably at the cutting edge of trying to build this movement is known as the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. Mm-hmm. They're online at www.poclad.org, known as moniker POCLAD.
Mm-hmm.
So at the national level, that's the group that does more sort of think tank work and writing and so forth. And if you want to actually work with folks who are trying to apply these thoughts into concrete action on the ground, then the group is Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, www.duhc.org.
And is Jeffrey Clements representing you pro bono, or do you have costs in this?
Pro bono.
Okay, good. Well, that is delightful.
Yes, absolutely. Listen, more and more people are waking up. Here's my concluding thoughts, Peter B. We are the sort of transnational corporations have sort of created a matrix. It's like the film The Matrix. People are sort of lulled into really a mirage, a sleep, if you will. But more and more people are waking up every day. And I am convinced that we are at the early stages of a really transformational moment in U.S. history that we will look back on it, and it will look a lot like the American Revolution, the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement. We are due in this country for the next major movement. And I think, frankly, that the election of Barack Obama was an early precursor to it. Not mm-hmm. because I think Barack Obama himself is going to lead us to this, but the progressive movement actually nominated Barack Obama, actually elected Barack Obama, that too many of the people are on the sidelines at this moment, but we need to get those people reengaged, and we can take our country back.
And David, let's talk about that a little bit, because it is, in fact, in my view, corporate interests that have really corrupted the change message that Obama ran on. And whether it's the bailouts to Wall Street, we nationalize the banks, in fact, but don't control them. Trillions of dollars have been pushed out without very much oversight or even good record keeping. He has decided to reappoint Ben Bernanke as the Fed chair, which sends a signal of continuity to corporate America. And that continuity is, keep on, greedsters. We're not going to really do anything significant to interfere with your plundering of our economy. And so what are your thoughts about the corporate orientation of the Obama administration in this first 8 months?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that not only who he has tapped to serve as the Federal Reserve, but the fact that he continued Bush's policies of the hundreds of billions of dollars going to Wall Street. I mean, that is a Bush-Obama policy, because Bush started it, but Obama continued the money to be flowing. The sad reality is that if you take a look at both who Obama has been funded by, it continues to be the same healthcare corporations. It continues to be Wall Street America. If you look at the appointments he's made to his cabinet, if you look at the policies that he's made, Barack Obama is not leading a progressive call to real change. He used fantastic rhetoric to excite and animate people, but the policies that he has proposed have been corporate policies. It's the reason we're still at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the reason that single-payer health care as a fundamental human right is not even on the table with the Obama administration. It's the reason that there is no call to dismantle the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, or any of the other treaties which are basically destroying the manufacturing base of this country and have us on a downward spiral for both workers' protection and environmental laws in this country. I mean, at the end of the day, Peter B., progressives nominated Barack Obama, progressives elected Barack Obama, but we are not holding him appropriately accountable for our agenda, because his agenda is a corporate agenda.
Well, and we have an opportunity here, because it's now numbering as many as 80 members of the House have signed on to the pledge of the Progressive Caucus not to pass a health care bill without what is still fuzzy and ill-defined and half a loaf, in my view, a so-called public option. If those people hold firm, I think it could send an important message to the White House and to Rahm Emanuel in particular, that progressives will not be taken for granted and will not be wedged in on this corporate agenda that they are clearly pursuing.
Peter B., think of it this way. In politics, if you are taken for granted, you've just been taken. And so far, progressives have, in fact, been taken for granted by the Obama administration and, frankly, by the Democratic Party generally. So I guess sort of my final appeal on this topic is this. I urge you to register into the Green Party. Even if on an election to election, you can decide who to vote for, but join 500,000 other Americans who have said, "Ya basta, enough already." I'm going to register Green as a way to add my voice to the chorus of an end to war as foreign policy, as a demand to make systemic changes to environmental protection to address the looming global climate crisis. I'm registering green as a way to say we want to fundamentally transform how our society operates.
Well, I encourage people to deeply consider that. I left the Democratic Party many years ago. I am an independent, declined a state voter here in California. And, David, I'm tempted to join the Green Party, and I can probably be persuaded. What I'd like to see is a strategy plan to win some number of House seats. If the Greens in this next cycle were able to unseat six or eight of these blue dog Democrats or even take a Republican seat here or there, I think that that small block could be pivotal in many future battles, legislative battles on Capitol Hill, and could help keep Democrats honest. Because one of the things that I articulated as Obama was running for president was the downside of one-party rule. And we're seeing it. Where progressives are being sat on and told, don't run, you know, don't advocate policies that conflict with the White House because we've got a Democrat in there. And that's a fundamental mistake that I think some of our progressive members are being squeezed into these days.
Well, I think you're right, and I would remind people, you know, people look back on the Clinton administration with some sort of nostalgia, and yes, Clinton was better than Reagan, but remember that Bill Clinton saddled us with NAFTA. Bill Clinton gave us the Defense of Marriage Act. Bill Clinton gave us the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which basically allowed the consolidation and corporatization of media at a rate we had never seen before.
Yep.
Bill Clinton gave us basically set up the security apparatus that basically was the precursor for the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, a corporatist Democrat is just a kindler, gentler version of the same corporatist, militarist agenda that Bush and Reagan represented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so I want to acknowledge that the rank-and-file Democrats that I know and work with are infinitely more progressive than the leadership of their own party. And so, folks, if you're not going to join me in registering green, if you're going to stay in the Democratic Party, then you better join the Progressive Democrats of America and take responsibility for the direction the Democratic Party is going.
David Cobb, always a pleasure to talk with you. You inspire me, man.
Thank you so much, Peter Boo, and thank you for what you're doing and to your listeners. And I want to say thank you also to the Organic Wine Company. I'm going to, I think, take a look at them for my next holiday shopping season because I'm always looking for organic wines, and knowing that there is a one-stop shopping place makes me happy.
Well, great. Thank you, David. Check it out, ecowine.com/Peter B, and you can get the starter pack at a very special price.
All right. Thanks so much for what you're doing.
You bet. Thank you. I'm going to saddle up and ride off into the sunset. Did I get that right? Thank you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.
Saddle up, ride off.
Happy trails.